The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Kate Geiss and Robert Aberlin, director and producer of a new modern dance documentary film, Paul Taylor, Creative Domain. Stick around. This movie is a beautiful thing. You won't want to miss it or this interview. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you preferred to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of prima ballerinas who, like Mr. Media, would give their left capizios to be in the Paul Taylor Dance Company in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. For all of my pop culture tastes, superhero movies, detective novels, losing sports teams, loud sitcoms, there has always been a place in my heart for opera and dance. I know, my wife doesn't believe it either. Still, it's true. Being able to sing opera is an incredible gift, as is the opportunity to see it performed. Seeing Luciano Pavarotti live in 1984 for me sealed that. And when it comes to dance, while I've always admired the physical skills of the dancers, particularly modern dance, the process of creating the dance has always fascinated me. I first realized my interest in this amazing art while, of course, here we go back to pop culture, watching the 1985 film White Knights, starring the unlikely team of Mikhail Baryshnikov and Gregory Hines. Which brings me to a fascinating new dance documentary, Paul Taylor, Creative Domain. How does a new dance ever develop? Ever wondered? I have. Well, this film takes viewers somewhere they never expected to be, inside the Paul Taylor Dance Company rehearsal studio as the legendary Taylor's 133rd dance, Three Dubious Memories, takes shape. Taylor, who is in his 80s, has never allowed cameras to capture his creation before, and it is astounding to see. Not only do we see him teaching precise movements to his company and fixing his 2D concepts to the actual capabilities of his 3D dancers, but he allows us into his dance notebooks with the men and women as X's and O's, which even the most experienced NFL football coaches could only marvel at. Joining me to discuss this rare peek behind the curtain are the director, Kate Geiss, and executive producer, Robert Aberlin. Kate and Robert, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed your film, and you know what I really loved about it is that you take the viewer somewhere that he or she could not possibly go otherwise, and you show us things that we never could see without you.
And I wouldn't have been able to do this without Robert. Robert was the way in. Robert's known Paul for over 20 years, and he was the person who had to talk Paul into this.
Let's jump on that, because I actually wanted to ask, in a situation like this, Robert, what does the executive producer actually do?
Other than raise money for the film, and getting different people together for it, getting Paul to agree to it, took years. It took me about 4 years, and I had known him, let's say, 15, 16 years at the time. And Paul would often say to me, who would ever be interested? Nobody will be interested in this. Why do you want to do this? So it was talking to him at the right moments, at the right time. One of the things we tell people is, a few years before we went in to shoot this film, I had been talking to Paul and John Tomlinson, the executive director, because the company was trying to raise money for outreach programs that the Taylor 2 company, the smaller company, did. And I kept saying, I don't even understand. What does outreach mean? What do you really do? And so we got the agreement to go up and follow the Taylor 2 company for 3 days in Syracuse, New York, where they went to hospitals and churches and schools, and see what it was. And then at a gala performance where they tried to raise money for Taylor 2, where they usually raise $40,000 or $50,000, when people saw the film, they raised $180,000. So suddenly, Paul got very interested in that. And it was the little legitimacy that of filmmaking that we needed to convince him to let us in.
Well, it's really it's really a mind-blowing experience to see the creation. I mean, and Kate, I can only imagine. I know that beyond director, you also edited the film. It's hard to imagine all the things that you had to leave on the floor, and it must have just killed you to have to cut this film.
It took a while because I've been a fan of Paul since I was a kid. And I think initially I had to get over the fact that I, you know, this is a person I really admire, and I kind of had to get to work and think about it as Paul does about his work, which is that it is a craft. And making a film is also a craft, and editing is a craft. So in order to do the work of making something that the audience will be able to kind of really sink their teeth into and get behind into his studio and into his world, you have to let go of the icon and think about the man, the human being, and the artist, and take him in that very personal way. And I think that was sort of our goal, was to make this something that everyone could relate to, because we are just seeing him do his work.
And Robert, as someone who has known him for a long time, did it nonetheless open your eyes to see him captured in his natural element? Did you learn things about him you didn't know?
I learned of so much about his methodology. Knowing him and seeing how he is so disciplined and so meticulous, I really didn't know much, if anything, about these notebooks he kept. And all of a sudden, he opened them up to us. And you see how he spends months thinking about the work. This is not just going in and making it up as, you know, this is really a craft that he has spent years working on. And I had no idea that that went into it. And seeing all the football plays, as you said, at the beginning, you know, the X's and the O's.
That was stunning. I mean, that was absolutely amazing. And Kate, is there another dance film that had come before you that maybe you kind of had in mind as you put this together, whether on the directing side or later on the editing side, or was this wholly, you know, unaffected by anything previous?
I think we're always affected by works that we've seen before, or whether or not they're films that are dance films or films that are fiction films. There is one influence for me as a kid was seeing The Children of Theater Street, which is a documentary about the Ghana Ballet School in St. Petersburg, Russia, not Florida. And that film I saw when I was a child, and I think that had an impact on me in terms of thinking about place and how that influences a dance. Another piece of this... you're bringing up some questions that are kind of going into more into the fiction realm of things. things. I've been influenced by films like Chariots of Fire, the Black Stallion. The way music is used in films like that, I think, made me think a little bit about how we use the track, the soundtrack of the music for this dance is kind of the through line of our film as well. I didn't introduce any other music than the music that Paul would have used, because the film is supposed to reflect him, and it's supposed to reflect him as a creator. And so I didn't want to impose any of what I thought was my music aesthetic on it, but just to take the work that he was drawn to and then use that as a thread throughout the film.
Well, and the music is very interesting in and of itself, in that the dance is to a soundtrack by a composer that Paul did not know.
Right.
It was sent independently. And then we meet the composer who admits, first thing he says on film at least, is, I don't know anything about dance. And, you know, he's asking questions as kind of, I guess, someone like I would, you know, as more of a fan than someone who is imagining that his work is being used in this way. Was his introduction into the film, was that, that seemed to me potentially one of the few theatrical moments that was actually... I don't want to say it was scripted, but it was introduced that maybe that wouldn't have happened otherwise if this was not being filmed.
It was definitely not scripted. It was important to us because it was so atypical of what Paul does. I mean, there's so much classical music in Paul's work, or work with composers that he knew, like Donald York. But to receive something out of it, I mean, he listens to music all the time. To receive this piece and just be taken by it was unusual. It's sort of the serendipity of what happened while we were, this happened before we were shooting. But in shooting at this time in this place, none of that was scripted. It was fortuitous, but it was not scripted.
I think what is wonderful about Peter's part of the story, too, is that it allows us as the audience a way in. You know, we get to experiencing Paul creating the work and the dance as the audience. And then when Peter comes into this, we're kind of in the studio in his place witnessing that dance at the same time and, you know, thinking about it. Obviously, we're not the composer, but, you know, he has that fresh, those fresh eyes, and you can watch those reactions on his face to kind of understand, you know, you get the whole spectrum of Paul's type of creativity, which is like having, you know, this beautiful thing unfold in front of you at the same time this horrific thing unfold in front of you, and then these humorous moments. And so that's all reflected in Peter's face.
And Kate, it seemed like something like this is more about documenting than directing at the time it's happening. How do you shoot this and stay the hell out of the way so that you're kind of a fly on the wall, and as opposed to Paul or the dancers getting ticked off all the time that you're, you know, in their way?
So we hired Tom Hurwitz, the cinematographer, to be the fly on the wall in the room with him, and Robert and I were sort of off to the side, trying to stay out of the way so that Paul could just be in the space with his dancers and have the minimum number of people that really needed to be in there documenting. So it is a process to be gotten still, like what questions do we need to be asking, what storylines are kind of coming out in the process of creating, so that when we go back in the studio, we're kind of following those stories. But really, we had to put a lot of our faith and trust, and it was very easy to do this, in Tom Hurwitz, because there was the relationship that he had established with Paul in filming Dance Maker, which is a film, an amazing film that came out in 1998 and really told the story of Paul's dances, the history of the company, and his history.
But we stood in another room, actually, next to the studio, and we listened to the audio feed, but we really didn't see what was happening. And after a shoot, we'd get back together and talk and try and fill in if we had to. But Tom really did a brilliant job.
One of the things that Paul says during the film is that his goal is to achieve 1 minute of finished dance from every 90-minute rehearsal. And, you know, it hadn't occurred to me until just now. That's probably about your goal in making the film. You've got an 80-minute film. I actually don't know. How long was the dance itself when it was finished?
21 minutes.
Okay. I thought it was – I didn't think it was, like, feature length. So that's what I wondered. So
Well, you don't see the whole dance in the film either.
Right.
We cut some pieces of out of it.
Well, obviously, yeah, I wouldn't assume that we would see the whole thing, but I didn't think it was like 60 or, you know, 70 minutes long. But still, to have that much that had to cut, what kind of things did you cut that you wish you could have left in?
In terms of the story or in terms of the dance itself?
The story about Paul and the company.
Well, I think sometimes, you know, one thing that piece of the rough cut. When we get to Texas, which is where the film, where the dance premiered, there's a lot that happens at the stage of the dance coming onto the stage and being crafted in a different way with the lighting director, with Jennifer Tipton, with Santoloquasto's sets and costumes. There's a lot more there that would be another fascinating, you know, section of the film to watch, but at that time, you're kind of in this mode of really wanting to see the dance performed. You're kind of on this train that's moving ahead. And to linger too long in certain sections would kind of lose the momentum of the film at that point. So those are times where it would have been nice to include, as an example, Amy Young and Sean Mahoney navigating how they were going to roll off stage and some of the humorous moments that came out of that. But again, it was sort of this call of, we need to kind of get to the main event and get to that dance and show all this beautiful work coming together. So that's kind of where you kind of make some judgment calls and try to internally decide, you know, for me, editing is about things changing in a musical way. Every kind of in phrasing and in, is this new information? And there is a sort of internal dialogue that I kind of have with myself and try to keep momentum going.
Physically, every time that Paul Taylor is on the floor with his dancers and demonstrating movement, which is astounding if you consider his age, he still looked to be in great pain. did he ever comment off camera about this?
No. I think it may be that it's part of the life of a dancer. I mean, I think he's just so used to having done that as a dancer himself. Part of, in that same moment I was describing earlier, you know, dancers were saying something about in that process of rolling off the stage, it hurts. And Paul kind of laughed. He's like, well, everything hurts. You know, that's part of being a dancer and the day in, day out of, you know, rehearsals and then performing and having to kind of regroup and get your body back together for the next performance. So that may be that he doesn't complain because he's used to it.
At the early on, as the rehearsals are beginning and he's explaining the dance as it's going to unfold, he's showing what he'd like, and the dancers are attempting it, and they're having trouble staying balanced and
right.
All that kind of thing. And you go, I wonder if this will ever work out, right? So later, as it's smoothing out, and there's input from others around Paul who are suggesting, well, maybe if they did this, like there's one point where Paul wants the male dancer, who's kind of on his knees, to bring the woman back over her shoulder and then lift her with his legs and stand up. And he's having a real hard time with that. And he says, well, maybe you could just stay on your knees and do it. And over time, we see how this develops and how it all, you know, somehow, incredibly, it all comes out. But there's one point where, I love this, where there's three dancers, one female and two male, and I'm sorry, I don't know everybody's names, but
right.
He wants them to become entangled.
Mm-hmm.
And they start giggling, and this happens a lot during the film. They start giggling because it's so the contortions are so ridiculous, right?
Yep.
You know, is there much discussion about that? I mean, and that it actually becomes something by the end.
I think that's part of the nonverbal communication. You know, dance is nonverbal. So, and the moments where, you know, there's a similar moment to what you're describing, where the choir is all seated on each other in a row, And I think, you know, Paul may have in his mind had this kind of sense of what it would look like. And then once he actually has the dancers in front of him doing it, he just realized how funny it looked. And so he starts laughing and the dancers all start laughing. And so that's, again, another moment where there is humor in even serious choreography that just comes up because, yeah, it's as Paul says, it's unnatural. And so he can find the humor in those moments, too.
Robert, is your friend Paul normally a talkative guy outside of the studio?
No, not at all. No, as it's said in the film, he observes, he watches. He says, I'm never alone when I'm alone. You know, I remember once he was meeting with me in an office in Manhattan, and he got there early and he just sat in the plaza and waited for half an hour because our appointment was at such and such a time. And he's a gentleman. He wasn't going to come up early. And I said, why did you do that? You just come up. I was here. And he said, no, I was watching people. There was a homeless person there. And I think I'm going to use something he did. And so he gets from places that we don't see. You know?
Another thing he said in the film is, he has a somewhat different approach to rehearsals than maybe other directors, in that he specifically talks as little as possible in rehearsals because it eats up time and it's not helpful. Mm-hmm. Which and you have dancers who talk about over time how their nonverbal relationship develops with him. They just sort of get to the point where they understand what he wants. And I think the woman who is is it Amy who's kind of the star of this production.
Mm-hmm.
She says that she'd been with him for like 12 years. He could never quite figure out for a long time. And then suddenly she just understood the relationship. And now finally she's starring in one of the productions. It's just it's that whole nonverbal thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. Right,
yep.
Right.
Yeah. I think also that it's part of her stories, too, is the sort of realization of the artists, the dancers in the company all bring their own artistry, and Paul chooses them for not only their ability as dancers, but who they are as people. And that makes them, you know, pretty fantastic interview subjects as well. They're very intellectual. They're very articulate about dance. It makes for a much more deep experience of the documentary because they're able to put words to things that are nonverbal as well.
You know, they talk in the film about colors. Many people talk about the colors of each dancer. And we've asked a few of the dancers, what does that mean? What color are you? And they talk, like one of them, Andy, who's the assistant now, was talking about how he was sort of yellow. He was sunny and bright and always up. And, you know, and he sort of got cast into those kind of roles. So it's very interesting how the visual color gets explained verbally into something.
Well, and you also capture, we don't spend too much time on it, but you do capture that there are relationships within the company itself, and including, of course, the leading lady and one of the male stars, and then there's two guys that have the relationship. And it's interesting. You can't spend a whole lot of time on that, I guess, you know, because the focus is how the dance comes about, but nonetheless, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That is part of the creative process. I think that because Paul, you know, he chooses who is in his company, he chooses his dance family, and it would make sense for those dancers then to, you know, be drawn to each other. And there are, you know, relationships and marriages that have come out of the history of this company as well.
Now, Robert, are there any questions that still remain in your mind about Paul's process, having been this deeply involved?
How does he come up with it? he can be happy. You can have dancers that are happy, dancers that are dark, dancers that are lovely and loving. In a way, this dance sort of has elements of all of those. There's a part in the film after Richardson where Robert, one of the men, is talking about, well, it's, you know, it's not so ugly. Well, it is ugly, but it's funny, and you, and boy, we're not really in his brain, you know. We get a glimpse into his brain, but we don't really know each other, as he says. We really don't know each other. He just let us see some of him.
Mm-hmm. Kate, I have one last question. It's for you. What on earth is Paul Taylor chewing all the time? Is it gum?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking maybe it was chaw. You know, I kept saying it.
Yep.
He takes it out and puts it behind his ear at one point, and then puts it back.
Yeah. Yep.
And he used that in one of his pieces. Mm. He has the male chew gum, put it on the door jamb, mm-hmm. and then later on take it out. So he uses everything.
He's real.
he's definitely real. Yeah. And I don't want to give it away, but the last shot in the film was perfect for my questions before about is he in pain and moving mm-hmm. around. And I'll just leave it at that, because I was going to ask you about it, and then I thought, oh, I can't just give it away, can I?
Yeah.
All right, so folks, listen, you can see director Kate Geiss's new documentary film, Paul Taylor, Creative Domain, when it opens at Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York on Friday, September 11th, with a national release in multiple cities to follow, such as Los Angeles, Boston, Chicago, Hartford, being a whole bunch of places. You just got to keep your eyes open. Read the newspaper, for God's sakes. It'll tell you where it is. Or you can go to the website, which is paultaylorcreativedomain.com. Are you guys, is the movie on, do you have a social media presence, Facebook, Twitter, things like that?
We have a Facebook page, and we would love for you to join it, because that's where there's a lot of really cool behind the scenes of the film there that people can see.
Very cool. Well, Kate Geiss, Robert Eberlin, it's a wonderful film. I'm so glad that you were available and I got to watch it. And I really hope that a lot of people will come to see it, and Paul Taylor will come to understand why we are so fascinated with this process. So thank you very much for being guests today on Mr. Media.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We enjoyed it.
Turn off the stereo receiver.